What's up, everybody? We're here for Mudball Monday.
And that's the question that I have for you is like, what do you think in these backroom discussions? Like, what do you think the SSG is helping the PGA Tour with? What do you think this money is going to do immediately?
You know, you started to mention the architecture piece there. I think that's a piece of this conversation that's just simply missing is that, we've seen it a million times. Like, look at Riviera. Every single year, and look at Augusta every single year. And every time that we go to, you know, the really great US Open venues, like there's a reason that it's the top guys in the game that show up. Look, if you want to become a Basel guy, go for it. But just curious.
I'm not closed to the idea.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mudball Monday, episode 120. We appreciate you joining us. As always, my name is Henry Shimp. I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Walker Simas. Walker, what are you up to?
What's going on, everybody? It's a rainy day in Tampa, Florida. It was gorgeous yesterday. It's pouring down rain. And frankly, I'm sitting here next to my Mudball half calf. Does it get any better than just the ambiance of rain during recording with a little Mudball half calf next to you? I'm not sure if it does. So, yeah, good to be here.
I was just outside and it's like perfectly sunny, which I mean, I respect the vibe that you have going, especially with the Mudball half calf flowing. But I'm not going to argue with like 66 and sunny in the morning that
never
gets the job done, as the people say. It's Mudball Monday. We will talk some golf as usual, a little bit of golf. Today's actually quite a bit of golf. We're talking PGA Tour Enterprises, the strategic sports group. We've got the inside track on what's going on here, and plenty of stuff that I think the people will be curious to hear about. But what we know for damn sure the people are curious to hear about is the dirt, the drinking, the eating, the reading, the thinking. I will go second. Mr. Simas, you go first. Lay it on me. What's the dirt for this week?
Dropping them. Here we go. Okay, drinking. I've had a slew of things this week, but from the hydration front, I've had a lot of coconut water this week. And been in and out on that. Spent a lot of time in the sauna. The coconut water goes a long way. I got back into we'll cover this just to keep the ads out, but I've been dabbling with some electrolyte powders and have really been enjoying those as well. And then of course our Mudball half calf hit the hammer button on the reorder. For Good Walk Coffee, we've got South American Dark heading our way. We've got some more Mudball Half Calf heading your way, and we are also dabbling in the caffeinated beans again, trying to figure out what our next brew is going to be for you guys. So we'll keep you posted in the weeks coming up, let you know kind of what we're going with. My gut right now is telling me some kind of light and dark mix. I've fallen in love. I think we both have kind of fallen in love with the South American dark, but we'll see how that irons out. So we'll keep you posted. Henry, just for the people, you know, if they're looking to order some Good Walk Coffee, where are they going? What are they doing?
What should they do? You know, I mean, it's important to know. And I've got a quick Good Walk story here that I will share in my dirt. But goodwalkcoffee.com, use code the tithe. That is THETIE at checkout for anything on the site. If you want merch, if you want the Mudball half calf, if you want the South American dark, if you want the Dew Sweeper medium dark, which is what I've been gaming, the code the tie, 20% off anything on the site. Get after it. What have you been eating?
All right. So Saturday morning did a little drop in. There's a guy that I know here who's doing some really great donuts. He's kind of a dough prodigy of sorts, like has been experimenting since he was 10 years old. And I was talking to him after our run. We dropped in, got, you know, half dozen donuts. They do a special each week. The special this week was strawberry and basil, which was just fucking so good.
Do you say basil as opposed to basil? I am not opposed, for the record, but
I don't. I kind of took that one out of your playbook, okay. Henry Shimp. But
it's a British thing. But yeah, look, if you want to become a Basel guy, go for it. But just curious.
I'm not closed to the idea. But they do three donuts that I really like. They're all the same dough of sorts. It's a 2 day ferment, a little bit of yeast, not sourdough. They fry lightly. I did not ask what they fry in. Frankly, I don't really want to know. And they did this like chocolate glaze with sea salt money. They do kind of like a, it's not quite butterscotch, but it's more of like a vanilla bean type glaze with pistachio, maybe a little bit of like orange peel in there. There's definitely some orange going on. And then what was the third one? Oh yeah, the strawberry and basil. Just very nice. What else did we get into? Pulled in, dude, like we went rafting yesterday, pulled in a McDonald's and got some McDonald's fries. Like that's got to make it into the dirt. What else? Picked up some pizza last night. Shout out to Sally O'Neill's, in my opinion, the best pizza in Tampa, which is not some great win or anything. Like the pizza game here is utterly atrocious, but they do have good pizza. So that's kind of what I've been eating. Reading, I've been just started this book by Bob Goff, finished up The Hacking of the American Mind this week and just picked up this book called Everybody Always. And I like Bob Goff. I've read a couple of his books, but it's a book about community and just kind of taking notice to other people and how you interact with them and how they interact with the world and just kind of picking things up there. So excited to get into this one. And then I've been thinking about range recently, like the range that you or others can have in different conversations and in different industries and in different interests and hobbies and all that. And I love people who take interest to a lot of things and can talk nicely in lots of different areas. And I had a couple conversations this week and this weekend with people who just wowed me with like, wow, you're really proficient in this, but you also have a lot of hobbies outside. I just find that sort of thing so interesting. So that was kind of what was on my mind this week. Short, quick dirt. That's all I got for this week. Henry, what you got for us?
Start leading off with a D. So quick good walk story. Last weekend was having a chat with a friend and somehow we got around. I do not sit, you know, it's not like my first bullet point when I talk to someone like, hey, have you heard the Talk Podcast? But somehow we got to, oh yeah, you know, I have a podcast. It's about golf. You probably wouldn't care, whatever. And so this guy goes and checks it out. He's a friend that I work out at the same gym as. And so like 2 days later, he's like, dude, like enjoying the pod first, but second, you know, I checked out a Mudball Monday. You guys are talking about this coffee, you guys like have a brand. And I was like, well, we don't have a brand, but we have some friends at Good Walk Coffee. And you know, of course I'm sitting there, it's like 6 a.m. I've got my coffee in hand. And I was like, you know, I actually have some right here if you're curious. And he goes, well, I'm not going to take a man's coffee. But I would like to try it at some point. So I show up strapped the next day with like 24 ounces, poured this guy a nice 6 or 8 ounces and we have a convert. So You should be a convert as well. As we mentioned before, at goodwalkcoffee.com using code the tie, THETIE. That is my drinking. Moving on to my eating. And this will kind of dip back to my drinking. So I mentioned what I don't drink in the airport or around flights last week. I talked about try to avoid the coffee other than early in the morning at the airport and airport beers. I'm out on what I'm in on. And I know you well enough to know you're getting ready to just like fall over on the table. But I do like a tomato juice on the plane. Tomato juice is solid and it's a great hydration drink. Plenty of sodium in there. Tomato juice complemented with water is a really nice airplane drink. So the way this gets into my eating, I was in Nashville just for the day on Tuesday. And I don't know, when I'm there like for work, I just don't see myself like ripping hot chicken. But we do have a Hattie B's coming to Austin soon and I'm gonna get after that. Anyway, there's a Hattie B's in the airport again. Not really looking to like crush hot chicken when I'm on business travel, but they had some seasonings and I was like, ooh, that I'm curious about. So they had a mild, I'm asking the guy, I was like, come on, like situate this for me. How hot are we talking here? They had a mild, which is, you know, self-explanatory, no action. Medium, the guy's like, yeah, there's some action. And then hot. And he's like, you better be careful with that one. So, you know, I'm an idiot. So I got the hot. I wanted to see what we were working with. So I sprinkled a little bit of the hot in my tomato juice when I was on the plane, mixed it up, took a sip, and I was like, yo, that was like a quarter teaspoon. So finally to the eating tonight, I have a half chicken that I'm going to roast. And she has been rubbed liberally with that Hattie B's hot seasoning. I am out for pain, hazmat on. Promises to the Mudball Monday hardos that are listening on Monday morning right now. It'll be on the story this evening. I'll get like the last handful of bites. Like, I will be finishing this chicken. I might be crying when I'm done. I might be okay. We shall see. It's going to be good. I just don't know how much pain I'm really in for, but we will keep you posted. Moving on to my reading, The Gambler, still working through that one. Something that's hit me like midway through this book is that, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't consider myself to be an addict to gambling, nor really anything for that matter. And so as I've gone through this book, I think you just have to like, you have to situate your mind a little bit differently reading something like that when it's written by someone who is like a terrible gambling addict, because I just can't compute some of the things. Like, this guy, Billy Walters, for the first like 35, 40 years of his life, it was just like a heart rate monitor of, so, you know, I kind of got my wits about me, got 500,000 in the bank, gone, you know, one bet. All right, we're back down to zero. Few million bucks. Like, I spent a year just like focused, doing working, et cetera, et cetera. One big bet, gone, back down to zero. Like 20 iterations of like betting all of his wealth on one game or something, of like playing pool against somebody and just losing it all. Just crazy, absolutely crazy concept. It's been a really interesting book. Those that are into autobiographies and especially a kind of wild story, I would highly recommend The Gambler. Just don't get into that sort of action, I wouldn't say. Okay, so moving on to my thinking, it's been a minute and it is time for some live thoughts. I was just watching a couple YouTube replays of Liv. I've got some sobering and very non-sobering thoughts here. Okay, first and foremost, the music is still just like, I cannot get my head around it. Like, three songs in a row just on this YouTube replay here, I was like, oh, like I've been hearing that song a lot. Like, where do I? Oh, it's on my gym playlist, and I'm like, no, like we shouldn't have a pro golf tournament that's playing the same music that people are working out to, at least in my opinion. That's a tough one. Secondly, the clown show continues. Jerry Foltz, great comment about Joaquin Niemann during the second round yesterday. The highly biased world ranking system does not currently have him in the Masters. And it's just kind of like a, you know, you asked that girl to the dance, you know, like, don't tell me when you get there that she wasn't good. It's just a tough scene. My sobering live thought of the day. I just one guy after another, and you've got your ass clowns. Don't get me wrong. Pat Perez, who will always catch not drive-bys, but just straight missiles from this podcast, of course, mm-hmm. out there in all his glory. You know, you've got the guys that are just over the hump, the Graham McDowells and just whatever, but just too many guys consecutively where I'm like, there's just no way that guy like never plays any real golf again. You know, there's just Taylor Gooch is playing a little bit too well to never make a run in a major or something like that. You know, a Caleb Surratt, a guy who we talked about last week, he's turned pro, gone live, watching him in the Walker Cup this summer. I mean, that guy was just stones. And to think that Caleb Surratt, who is not a whole lot worse than Nick Dunlap at golf, is never going to be in the limelight. We're never going to get to see him play real golf that's consequential. I don't know if I see that. So I'll use that as a platform to go straight into our episode of what's happened kind of in the other side to some degree of the program. We're talking PGA Tour Enterprises. We're talking about the announcement this week with the Strategic Sports Group. So I guess we'll just lay out a couple things here that have gone down, what it kind of means for golf fans, and potentially how we translate that into, okay, is this going to be a better product for us? What are the things that maybe aren't being talked about? What would we like to see more of, et cetera? So starting out with PGA Tour Enterprises and the Strategic Sports Group. So we've made the decision here that the Strategic Sports Group, which essentially is a consortium of guys that for all intents and purposes, you can call it the Fenway Sports Group. You do have the likes of Arthur Blank and a few others in there, but it's essentially the Fenway Sports Group, which is the ownership group of a bunch of the Fenway teams, excuse me, the Boston teams. FC Liverpool is under their ownership as well. Big professional sports team ownership group. So clearly they have a very strong playbook of how you create value through a professional sports-based entity, particularly on the media side. So they have partnered with the PGA Tour and are making a $3 billion strategic investment. What's included in this is that players will end up being given up to $1.5 billion total in equity. Now, one thing that I think is interesting is the concept of, okay, so like, do guys get diluted in the future potentially as whoever the Nick Dunlap of 7 years from now is that comes up? And I mean, surely that guy's going to get equity. Like, equity is kind of oftentimes is going to be a one-time thing, but you're probably going to see plenty of follow-on equity in this as well. And, you know, does Rory McIlroy end up being diluted significantly over the course of 15 or 20 years? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. So that's that. The way in which this will be doled out, I mean, no surprises here. Like, legacy, your kind of history on the tour, the things that you've done for the tour. I mean, there's a great argument to be made that the cat should get 50% of the total equity. I don't think he's going to take that, but you know, that's one side of it. If you're some tiny PGA Tour player and you get 25 basis points, you should probably be pretty pleased with yourself. You know, if you're Peter Malnati and maybe you're not the best player out there, but you've been a very integral part in this whole negotiation, like he's probably going to see more than a percent or two of this PGA Tour equity, I would have to imagine. So that's that piece of it. The complete and utter just like capitulation, kick the can down the road, we don't care, we're not making a decision, the verbiage of the PIF will have the option to co-invest in the future, which is just like, okay, so we've done precisely nothing. I saw some Twitter threads of like, oh, we've made the decision here, like they can co-invest, and I'm like, I don't think anyone was saying that that wasn't on the table as of 3 months ago. It's just now that we're actually formally saying like, oh, they can co-invest in the future whenever that may come. So nothing has happened there. The allegiance with the DP World Tour is top of mind. They're going to continue to try to strengthen the ties there and bring a lot of the good European players onto the PGA Tour and have you know, a good relationship between those two. And then final piece here that's important. We were talking about this yesterday. I noticed that there are three guys that are part of this strategic sports group consortium who are owners of TGL teams, which I think is interesting. I think it's very interesting because while I do back the strategic sports group to be able to fulfill their goal to create value through this new for-profit entity of PGA Tour Enterprises and grow the game, dare I say, they threw in there. If these guys are pulling in the TGL playbook, homie, so far I haven't seen a lot of value created through the dome collapsing and just telling us to wait and see. That was an asterisk that I would throw in there that I'm pretty concerned about. So that's kind of the groundwork. Walker, anything on top of that that you want to add, that you want to talk about? And then, you know, if not, like, let's go ahead and flip it a bit and talk about, okay, well, where does the golf fan fall in all of this? Like, what are they really going to try to do to make this more interesting? What have they tried to do? Where have the conversations gone up until this point? And then what are we potentially missing here? What is not being talked about when it comes to actually creating more value for the golf fan as opposed to just purely creating more value for the golfers themselves?
So, yeah, I mean, there are a million ways to go from here, but what I want to do first is kind of reflect on a couple points that you made there. And the first thing that I want to talk about is this $1.5 billion being distributed amongst players and kind of get that out of the way first, because I think one thing that all of us know is that the players have gotten the most love over the last 2 to 3 years as this has been an ongoing discussion. And who's been neglected, who's been left behind, those are the other obvious stakeholders and or just like key components in the PGA Tour model, professional golf model. The first thing is viewership numbers. Like, how much really did Cat move the needle? We've talked about this hundreds of times and most of it's speculative, but like, we all recognize the weight of which Tiger moved the game. And I was looking at simply just the major viewership numbers this week, and We've been steadily decreasing. I didn't necessarily realize this, but we've been steadily decreasing just in the majors in viewership numbers since 2001. But from 95 to 2001, we were crushing it. And then, like, the obvious question is how much of that was Tiger? The answer is a lot. But I mean, like, in 2001, the viewership Sunday at the Masters when Tiger won was 19.2 million people. And when he won in 2019, it was 10.8. But the average between, let's say 2008 and 2021 is hovering around, 8, 9, 10 million. Whereas between 99, 1995 and 2001, you're looking at like 11, 13, 14 million.
For
It's a
really quick context,
big fucking
I heard the
difference.
number last night that was 55 million people who watched Chiefs Ravens this past weekend. So not even the Super Bowl. And you're 3x give or take where your biggest viewership is ever going to be in golf.
Right. And there's a lot of questions we could ask about, what does it mean to have SSG now part of this, and what can they actually bring to the table as far as just like super binary, just viewership numbers. I have no idea what that looks like. For those who know me well, they know that I'm not like a big sports guy. I don't like follow a bunch of teams. I don't really have a great understanding as like what these new board members will actually bring to the table as far as like raking people in to the golf world that weren't part of it beforehand. I have no idea. But I do think it's interesting to say, hey, look, Tiger did move the needle significantly since he's left the game. Viewership numbers have dropped. How much of that is the TV model? Slash, I mean, look at what's happening on social media right now. We've immensely shortened our attention spans and the players who have done really well on
Keep those
social
attention span sports. Watch the
have just,
reels.
yeah, seriously, like
The
I'm
Tide Podcast
wondering,
reels.
plug it, baby. I'm wondering if we need to, as the PGA Tour, need to focus on like condensing. Golf takes so much longer than these other sports to play, to capture. Like, it's not that we want to throw that to the side and say, hey, don't watch, 4 hours of the Sunday coverage, but we need to do a better job of getting people there, and that happens through content, basically. So I think part of this investment needs to go towards that. I think that's pretty clear. Anyways, moving aside from the players, I want to ask you a couple questions relating to the other stakeholders. So the sponsors, the media, and then of course the fans. Let's start with the media, I guess. So there's kind of this kicking the can down the road discussion where like, the PIF hasn't technically invested. They have the option to co-invest. As you said, nothing new here. But we are still anticipating this like equilibrium where the best players in the world want to play together again. We know that there's no other answer. They have to. They will eventually end up doing this. And I get the sense that the main need of the media is for this to happen. Like, until the media has what it needs to do to do a great job, to get all this speculatory bullshit out, to get the meaningless Twitter rants out, we just need all the best players in one field so that we can get back to covering what is actually worth covering, which is, who's going to win this golf tournament. And then the sponsors. And that's the question that I have for you is like, what do you think in these backroom discussions, like what do you think the SSG is helping the PGA Tour with? What do you think this money is going to do immediately to mend the relationships with the sponsors? Because I guess the main question that I'm trying to get to is, are we simply with this new investment, are we delaying the process of like PIF is on our ass? We are just buying some time? Or is this like, hey, we actually have some leverage now against the PIF? I'm not sure which one of the two it is right now.
So on the sponsors, I have to imagine, I mean, given that essentially, as I mentioned, the Strategic Sports Group is the Fenway Sports Group, it's just the playbook of what's been done with professional baseball, professional basketball, professional football. How have they created value over the last 30, 40 years for their sponsors and monetized this product as well as they can? Something that so many people are interested, as I mentioned. I mean, it's not as many in professional golf, but we're also not talking about a multiple of 50 or 100 either. I mean, there are a lot of people that are really interested in golf, and that interest seems to continue to go up. Clearly, if you have someone like the PIF that's willing to pump the amount of money they have into the game, there's a lot of value to be created. And I think it's a good play on the PGA Tour's part to say, okay, we have not maximized our value here, and here's someone that's willing to partner with us that has done it in other sports. Surely golf can't be that different. And in my mind, that's probably pretty square logic. And I think that they probably will do a very good job of figuring out on the media side, on the content side, as you mentioned, like, what are we missing here? What do people want from these players? What do they want to see? Is it behind the scenes stuff? Is it a better TV product? Like, what is it? But I think that they're going to have better answers than potentially Jay Monahan would, or almost certainly Jay Monahan would, of how we're going to create better value here. So I think when it comes to the PIF, I just think that it's ultimately going to be, I used the word capitulation earlier. Like, I think that the PIF is going to get so much more pressure from the players. And mm-hmm. I know that that's probably not, I don't know how much power, if any, that the LIV guys necessarily going to be holding here over the PIF. But I do think that we're going to get to a point where the LIV guys are just going to be like, hey, look, like, do you want us or not? Because we'll make a deal here, whether it means I have to sit out for two seasons or I can't take prize money, whatever that looks like. I do think you get to a point where when the PGA Tour guys are making not as much money as the LIV players, but are getting closer and closer, and they're getting to play in all the events that people, I mean, if anyone ever says like, yeah, I just don't really care about the majors, they're just completely and utterly bullshitting. And so as that gap continues to tighten, I think you will see more and more guys over on the LIV Tour. Let's keep using Taylor Gooch as our example here, the guy who's, you know, maybe gotten the most out of LIV. Like, his game seems to have gotten just as good, if not better. He's made so much money doing it, way more than he would have over the last few years on the PGA Tour. Like, Goochman's going to be, I think he's probably, what, 33 or something like that, 32. That he's going to be 35 and still playing good golf and be like, shit, man, like, in 10 years, it's not going to be relevant. So, like, what do I do? Do I keep just, like, winning LIV events and not take or keep making money, but, like, I can't play in the Masters? Or do I figure out how to pound the table here and make this happen because I've made enough money? That's just kind of one example there. And I think that that's probably somewhat representative of how the LIV players will start to look at things. And as mm-hmm. they become, is they're clamoring to try to get back on the PGA Tour and play in the top events, that puts pressure on the PIF to me. So I think that's how it's done, essentially. As you continue to strengthen this product that is now PGA Tour Enterprises from both an importance standpoint as well as financial, the LIV guys are just going to finally be like, what am I doing over here? Like, this just doesn't make all that much sense. That's just my two cents. I want to get into the fandom side of this. Like, for the golf fan, I like what you said there a lot about, like, we have to get the best players together for media purposes. Like, the best media is going to come from the best players. In your eyes, like, what are we potentially missing here? What have we been missing over the last couple of years? Is there anything in this conversation about value creation and strategic partnerships and LIV and PIF and everything that goes on about creating better value through this product that we're just missing from the fan side of things?
I think there are two ways to look at this. The first I already mentioned earlier, which is the content side. I'm not sure the total number in, like, digital assets that the tour was holding as far as just like golf shots that the PGA Tour had ownership of. I could ask Phil. I'm sure he knows. But they're standing on top of something that they don't have to purchase. They already own. And they're doing a really poor job of distributing for their own benefit. And I think that is something they need to take a good hard look at. There are also so many people now, whereas 5 years ago, this wasn't true. Certainly 10 years ago, this wasn't true, who would be, for the right price, very willing to distribute and, like, help push this product if they were involved. And I think the money is certainly there. We've seen that with the players, you know, who have just gotten paid out arguably more than the sport is worth. And I, that kind of will be going on, some like kind of an ongoing discussion here of like, you know, the players have gotten the certainly the better end of this deal and things have to even out eventually. I just wonder if the fans continue to be disappointed when the PGA Tour says, hey, we need to figure out a different distribution model for all this, all these golf shots. And so I think that's something really interesting to look at. The other thing that I've dabbled in, and there are some complications here, which I'd like to discuss, but our venues, you know, we've got, I was looking at the viewership numbers for the actual PGA Tour, because it was easy to start with the majors, but really what we're talking about here is regular season events. We've discussed on Mudball Mondays prior how the majors are actually the only thing that's keeping us afloat, the only thing that the best players look towards. But what's really disappointed the fans, I think, is just that they only have 4, 5, 6 events to look forward to, and the rest of the season's kind of a toss out the window. And the viewership numbers are interesting. So technically, they were up 1% versus 22 on their regular season events, and the designated events on paper performed really well. I mean, they were up 5% versus the same events in 2022. And to me, that smells like a short-term win and a long-term loss. Like, I don't think those numbers are sustainable long-term.
And like hot chicken.
Like hot chicken, perhaps. We'll find out on Monday or Tuesday.
Short-term win, 24-hour loss.
That's exactly right. That was a great call out there. I just wonder what we're gonna do with these events. And I realize that there are complications in securing these venues and managing how the relationship with certain clubs goes. Like, I actually have never been part of the process of like securing a relationship with the club, figuring out all the logistics, making sure things go smoothly. I'm sure that is not insignificant in terms of the work that goes into it. But I know as a viewer, and I'm biased because I love golf course architecture, and I would rather see the best players in the world play at great courses versus, you know, TPC Summerlin or something. And I feel like most people share that view.
Most people.
Say that one more time. I missed it.
Most people. Most people.
I think this model of like PGA Frisco is an interesting thing to look at. We may be entering the era of like competitive golf being held at resorts. Resorts being, instead of private clubs, resorts kind of being the vehicle for high level professional play. Because we understand there's a gap between a lot of private courses lengthwise and just difficulty to secure those deals. But with resort play, I think you can build them so that they accommodate the regular player, but also can test the best players in the world. I feel like 10 years ago, there 20 years ago, there was this idea where, you know, hey, play where the pros play. That's not a half bad idea. And it depends on who you were, you know, 10 years or 20 years ago. Like, there were still a lot of great golf courses that weren't ever being seen on TV. But you look at Seminole, you look at Cypress, those courses have kind of opened their doors to TV coverage. But there aren't too many of those. PGA Frisco is a golf course that was quite literally built to house the PGA, to create revenue throughout the year, to accommodate players who are interested in architecture and potentially taking a trip, but also can test the best players on the biggest stage. They're built for being covered for TV. And I wonder if like Sand Valley or some of the Cabot properties, or, you know, we saw the US Amateur at Bandon Dunes. I'm not trying to be unrealistic and saying that, hey, we should just go play the best golf courses, because that's not a 5-year process. That's like a 25-year process if you really wanted to do something like that. But now that we're at this breaking point with the investment and a lot of things changing in the golf world, I really think we should look at two things, and that's how we distribute the digital assets, the golf shots that show up on our phones right in front of us. And I also think we should take a good hard look at the golf courses that we play and the golf courses that we build going forward. Like, if it's going to be resort play, let's build resorts that can house great championships and can also create revenue through resort play. I think that's feasible to do as long as you approach it that way. So we'll see how Frisco works out. I've seen the golf courses. There are two.
Bow Welling and Gill, great. Is that correct?
Yeah, Bow Welling and Gill. Both golf courses offer something different, but just big, big, you know, dare I say it, girthy golf courses. So we'll see how those fan out. The other thing that I kind of want to poke you about is PIF, right? So you got into earlier the live players kind of putting a little bit of pressure on PIF, if that's even possible. But what do you think, you know, Phil mentioned this long ongoing game of chess. Where do you think PIF is at? Where do you think LIV is at? What do you think the discussions look like after the PGA Tour SSG kick the can down the road? They seem like they've been ahead of everything. Like they've been anticipating the moves of the PGA Tour. What do you think those discussions look like right now?
I'm going to go back more or less to what I led on before, which is I really think it has to be okay. Like they're figuring things out. Guys want money. And they don't have what we do. They never will. They never can. But they're figuring out ways to compensate these guys in such a manner where they're going to stop worrying about taking their live deal, right? And so it has to be conversations around, okay, what are these guys going to want now? They are still highly, highly competitive professional golfers. They want to play in the biggest events. They don't want to just play the fucking Chameleon Classic or whatever they're calling it, Live Mayakoba, and play for $4 million and say that's cool when, you know, these guys are making nearly as much money anyway, and they're playing in the Masters and they're preparing to get into all of those events. And so to me, it just, it can't be like, oh, let's throw $500 million at Justin Thomas, like see if he bites on that one. Ah, shit. Like, okay, let's throw it at Spieth, you know, like let's just keep trying to get one player after another. The chessboard that you mentioned, I have no idea what that chessboard might look like. It is truly a game of wizard's chess. Mm-hmm. There's your Harry Potter reference for the day. Maybe somewhere on that chessboard, these fellas think that they can buy the majors. I don't know. I'm just completely making stuff up. But I do think that there's a world in which they truly think they can buy not just players, but they can buy everything. Because it's starting to get to that point where unless this is like just literally the tip of the iceberg in terms of how much money they want to give to players, which immediately pushes my mind to like, how much, what do you really need? How much do you want? Like, Phil, do you really need to be like a, you know, 8 times over billionaire to be happy with yourself? Like, is that the goal here? Maybe it is. I don't know. But I just have to think that we're getting to the point where it's like, okay, the money isn't what is like truly, truly moving the needle at this point. And therefore, we have to figure out how to create a partnership such that our players can play in the events that they're being deprived of by deciding to take the money and come to live. That's where my mind goes. Anything? Have you been thinking at all about PIF and what this could potentially mean? Is there anything that comes to mind for you there?
No, I agree. It's like 3D chess. It's hard to know what the next steps are going to be. But we keep on going back to the same thing, which is, the best players in the world have to compete on the same golf courses eventually. I'm not sure if this is 5 years away or 18 months away. And I think the only other thing that I can speculate on that I can think about is what is a domino, like an event that will piss people off enough on LIV or PGA Tour or the fans or the media or anybody, so that we say, guys, we got to do something. We're on both sides of the fence yelling at each other. When are we going to knock down the fence? You know, and that to me seems like the Ryder Cup right now. I'm not sure. I mean, Rory made his comments. Rom made his comments. Everybody's weighed in on Bethpage and what that's going to look like. And to me, I see how we can get through all four majors this year without actually making progress. But once you get to the Ryder Cup, I think you have to start really facing some of those discussions. So we'll see how that pans out. But right now, that's kind of what I'm looking at is Bethpage is our next date on the calendar when things will get shaken up a bit.
I want to go back to, you know, you started talking about golf courses a little bit, and it's easy to come off as just like the nerd golf course architecture hardos that just want to see golden age architecture and blah, blah, blah. People can think that means nothing, which to some degree probably is true. But I do want to revisit that conversation and kind of like start at the end and then make my way back to the beginning, which is that I think the entire goal, like if there's one thing other than money that's rung true over the last few years, it's that what matters, what we have to do for everybody's interest is get the best players together more. And so again, like taking it to the end and then making our way back, like, why are we doing that? What does it mean? Is it just fun in concept to be like, oh, well, John Rahm's on the seventh hole and Rory McIlroy's on the third? You know, it's like none of that matters if we aren't identifying the best players such that when we get late into the tournament, when it's back nine on Sunday at a major, we've identified who those best players are so that that's what we're watching, because people don't really care about holes one through seven. I guess they are just as important as holes 66 through 72. But ultimately, the goal is on those final holes of the tournament that we have not just gotten the best players into that field, but that we've identified them and they are the ones that are part of the storyline, because that's how we create for the best and most compelling golf. And so that's where, you know, you started to mention the architecture piece there. I think that's a piece of this conversation that's just simply missing is that, I mean, we've seen it a million times. Like look at Riviera every single year and look at Augusta every single year. And every time that we go to, you know, the really great US Open venues, like there's a reason that it's the top guys in the game that show up, and that all of a sudden, you know, Pat Perez back when he was on the PGA Tour just isn't part of the storyline in majors. Yeah, absolutely. Like you get some guys that stick their head up here and there that have a great week that maybe aren't your top 10 players in the world, but
shout out Wiersey.
I'd put a lot of money on any sort of statistics out there that said, if we go to what we've identified to be the best golf courses from both a competitive and architectural standpoint, and those two often marry, I'm not saying like if we go to Cypress Point that all of a sudden it's only the best players that will be identified, but we've seen it over and over that when we go to Oakmont and Augusta and Pinehurst and Wingfoot and all of the best places, that we're identifying who the best players are, and we are giving ourselves the best chance to have the most number of really high level players be the biggest part of the storyline come the end of the tournament. And so I think from a pure fans and halfway media perspective, I think that's something that is not discussed that should be, is that when it comes to where we're deciding to play these things, it shouldn't just be, oh, well, let's go there because it's historically significant and people will appreciate it. It's like, no, like let's go to places that probably do have really great golf course architecture that are going to give us the best chance to identify the best players. Because again, like taking it to the end, like that to me is ultimately what we're trying to do here. It's not just like, let's get the best field list so that we can pat ourselves on the back and say, that's fun. It's let's do that so that we can have the most compelling tournament.
Yeah, and no longer are we drawing from the same bucket. So you can't use a golf course or the weight of an event to pull the best field anymore. You have to just like, there's so many barriers. But golf course, the first priority is getting the best players in the world together. The second priority is doing that on better golf courses. Like I look at what OCM's done at Medina. Like, we are all eager to see the best players in the world compete again at Medina because there's history there. Like there's history of the best players in the world competing at Medina. And it's been restored and we're all excited to see the golf course. And that's a great example. Lido just got built. Like they have prioritized some competition. It'll take a few years to get the right field out there, but that'll be exciting to watch. You know, like again, this stuff is not going to happen over 5 years, but we have to start now. We have to start kind of knocking some chips off the block. The other thing that I thought about is, okay, like the Florida swing, the Texas swing, the California swing. And you go up to the Northeast. It's like, you know, I went back to the viewership numbers, the regular season PGA Tour events this year and how I felt they were kind of a short-term win, not a long-term win, not really sustainable. You know, I'm not sure what those relationships look like within the tour, but, you know, how could we potentially exchange some golf courses that aren't really popular amongst viewers or players for that matter, and swap them out for better ones in the same region and just change up those swings a little bit? One thing that I think we overlook sometimes is that when players are very excited to play a golf course, we as fans are very excited to watch them play. I mean, you see this at Pebble. We were at Pebble last week. We being PGA Tour players were at Pebble last week, and it's very clear that they enjoy being there. They enjoy being in Maui. They enjoy being at Riviera. They enjoy being at Arnie's Place. You know, and how can we get more of that if we have to turn over some old relationships and start up some new ones that actually have some long-term value, that are architecturally interesting and present well on television, that the players enjoy? That is something that we should do. We should do it now just because of where we're at in the sport. It's going to be very hard if we don't start now to do this 5 years from now. So, yeah, that ties a bow on most of my thoughts for today. Is there anything else that you want to dive into before we close out Mudball Monday today?
Very briefly, one of the top events of the year, in my opinion, coming up this week, we've got the Waste Management Phoenix Open. I hope I don't come off as a total head ass and be a week off here. I'm pretty sure it's this week. It could be next, but let's pretend it's this week. I think it's going to be a spicy one. I got a few names in mind of guys that I think are going to show out. What about you? Any particular players that you've been seeing good form from that you think are really going to make things exciting at the Phoenix Open this week? And please name players in the field. I would appreciate that.
Yeah, I was smelling that a little bit earlier. I think the Waste Management's such an important golf tournament. Like, that's a great argument for, I don't like the golf course that much. I don't even care. It's green and pretty and
I
super American.
Do. I think it's fun for tournaments though. I think they've kind of like continued to make it harder. Like they really bake that thing out now. And they've tried to dial things up. I think golf course is pretty intriguing. But anyway, but on you go.
I'm looking at the field right now.
Good boy. That's a good policy for you.
It's a little CYA move. Field. Let's see. Who's in the field? Cameron Champ's going to be hitting bombs. Austin Eckroat.
Not a terrible pick.
Young guy, Doug Gims in the field. What are we doing? Ben Griffin, another young guy making his name. Garrick Higo. Haven't seen much of him lately. You know what? This is a weird pick, but I'm going to go with Hideki. I like Hideki this week.
I think he has won there before, actually.
Yeah, I haven't seen much of him lately. And I'm going to go Hideki, kind of a random call. Anybody else that comes to mind? Pearson Cootie's in the field this year. Oh, he's
that's
an alternate.
That's fun.
Never mind.
Okay. We've been seeing good form out of Golden Boy, Spieth. I think Fowler, obviously, has been playing well for a few years or a year and a half or so now. And I've been really, really excited to see the form out of JT recently. It's just obviously great for the game to see him back playing again. So I think at least a couple out of those three guys are going to be key parts of the storyline. But the call that I'm making, and I might take one out of your playbook here, but correct me, you've got the field list up. I'm assuming Cameron Young is in the field for the Waste Management Phoenix Open. And it's just gone on too long that he hasn't won. Like I've been thinking about this a lot. He is in the field. We're confirmed
He is in the field, confirmed.
Good stuff. I'm just going with the Cameron Young call. Really non-contextualized. I don't know that he's been playing well necessarily. I just think that it's become a tournament where like hitting bombs, and this is true of like everywhere now, but like hitting bombs just means a lot, and he obviously hits bombs. And I think even though he hasn't been able to close it out for some reason, I think that he's just going to be like thrust into this scene, which is one of the bigger ones outside of the majors. And like that's where it's going to finally come together and happen, because I don't get how the guy, I mean, it's kind of Scotty Scheffler 2.0 really, where it's like, we know this guy is already one of the best, however many guys in the world. he just doesn't have a single win to substantiate that. And, you know, when it happened with Scheffler, it was just one after the other. And it's got to happen soon for Cameron Young. I don't think it's going to be a major. I just don't really believe in that guys are going to get their first win after like all of this stuff comes together at a major. But this would be a big event for it, and it's really time for Cameron Young. So that's my pick for this week. So
you know who else I like is a Stanford guy, Patrick Rogers, has been playing some great golf recently.
He has been playing some good golf, shit golf this week. He's going into the final round. He's paired with Nick Dunlap at Pebble. They are 79th and 80th respectively, so out of 80, so that's not so great. But hey, maybe that's exactly what we're looking at. Big fan of that. Shout out Billy Walters.
Hey, and also Libs in Vegas next week. We will ride Mudball Monday, and we'll see you soon.
Cheers.